Hail, this is Dr. Stan, back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course, we welcome your calls from out across America ordinarily at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, but we're not going to take any calls during this hour. We have with us on the line Mr. Gonzalo Marina, and we're going to be talking about what happened in Cuba. He was there, living in Cuba, at the time that Fidel Castro came to power. Now, most Americans think they understand what happened. Fidel Castro led a revolution, and he concealed the fact he was a communist, and then suddenly he started out as a communist, and then he was treated so badly by the Americans, he became a communist, and well, we're not quite sure how he became a communist, but we know he was an anti-communist, and he was backed by the American government, and then he became a communist, and he was opposed by the American government, and how did that happen? And then, of course, we're told how well people are living in Cuba today. After all, they have finest health care, they have education for everybody, they have prosperity, sort of an island paradise. Isn't it wonderful of what communism has done for Cuba? But there are a lot of unanswered questions about Cuba today. One of them would be, why is it that if somebody's trying to escape from Cuba and they are willing to get on a little raft or a little rowboat or however it would be that they're trying to get those 90 miles from Cuba to the Florida Keys, and they may be in sight of land, but if they are picked up and they will be stopped by the American Coast Guard, and if the Coast Guard captures them, they will be sent back to Cuba to be imprisoned and perhaps tortured and killed. Why would we be helping Fidel Castro? I thought he was the enemy. And then, of course, we all remember Elian Gonzalez. Why was it that when the courts had not yet decided whether Elian Gonzalez would be sent back to Cuba or not, why was it that Janet Reno, the Attorney General of the United States, sent 125 heavily armed men, a SWAT team down, to kidnap this little boy, to send him back to Cuba to build up the reputation of Fidel Castro? And, of course, to certainly discourage anybody in Cuba who wanted to try to escape, because it was very obvious that, in truth, contrary to all the rhetoric, why the American government had intentionally sent Elian Gonzalez back there against the will of his family living here in the United States. And, of course, his father had wanted him to come to the United States. But, of course, they were holding the father's family hostage in Cuba. And so they forced the father to say he wanted his son to return. It was all a staged thing. But why was the American government helping Fidel Castro in building up his prestige? And I would like to suggest that most of what you think you know about Cuba just isn't true. And with that as a background, thank you very much, Gonzalo, for being with us. Did I pronounce your name right?
You pronounce it right, Dr. Stan.
All right, fine. Why don't you tell our listeners just a little bit about yourself, first of all, what life was like in Cuba before Fidel Castro came to power, what life was like after Fidel Castro came to power, and then how you were able to come to the United States.
Well, the life before Fidel Castro came to power, it was a free country. It was, according to my memories, it was the only second to Argentina in education, regardless what he claimed today. And in, knowing that, different times, the medical system in Cuba was completely even better than even in the States.
All right,
at the time.
Hold that right there. We'll be back in just a moment with our special guest. And you're going to learn things about Cuba that you're never going to learn from the controlled media here in the United States. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Gonzalo Marina. We're talking about Cuba. And so Gonzalo was saying that really before Fidel Castro came to power, Cuba was a free country. Now, the American people have been told that Cuba was a dictatorship and they had to get rid of the right-wing dictator. Was Batista a dictator?
In a way, it's what you call a person that he wanted to be in power. But on the second hand, he celebrated free elections on 1958.
And, of course, he was elected to presidency in 1954. Right. And then, of course, when the terrorists, led by Fidel Castro and financed by the CIA and the United States, disrupted the society and they were creating all sorts of terrorist acts, why Batista had to actually suspend the Constitution on two or three occasions, didn't he?
Absolutely, because otherwise he was at a total chaos. And the problem was that, I think it was 1955, the American ambassador at the time, I don't remember his name right now, but he told Batista that they had to celebrate another election. Now, why after he got elected in 54, just a year later, for 4 years, they have to celebrate another election? It's like it's over here, somebody tell the President of the United States, you have to celebrate an election in 2001 or 2002. Now, the situation with Fidel, that where he landed in Oriente Province, he was near Nicaro Nickel Company. Now, Nicaro Nickel Company was a corporation that was part Canadian and part United States. That's where the nickel come from. Now, why he landed over there? Because he was under that particular mines, which are the nickel, and Cuba is the second largest mines in nickel producer. They have American soldiers protecting that place. Now, they chose that place for him to be safe, even though, you know, the mountains and the weather terrain and the scene, they eliminate a lot of his compadres. Or, you know, and in 1953 also, that's when he started his the movement that he called July 26.
All right, fine. And I think it's important for our listeners to understand the sequence of the events, what happened, and we're going to cover that in just a moment here.
Right.
All right, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, basically what happened is that Fidel Castro, in 1948, had led a communist revolution in Bogota, Colombia. He was a very young man at that time, in his early 20s. He went on the radio and said, "This is a communist revolution. I am Fidel Castro." So it was very obvious in 1948 he was a communist. In 1950 or 51, it looked like the country was going to go communist. The army had gotten Batista to actually lead this is the second time he had a military takeover of the country. But in 1952, there was I guess Batista came to power in 1953. Fidel Castro led an attack on Oriente Province, and that was July 26th. That's why it's called the July 26th movement. Gonzalo was saying, and I had never heard that, was the reason he picked Oriente Province to land was because there was an American nickel plant there guarded by American soldiers, whether they were military soldiers or just certainly mercenaries, I don't know. But under any circumstances, why the movement was defeated, Fidel Castro was arrested and sent to the Isle of Pines, which was a prison. But at that time, the Isle of Pines wasn't such a bad place. Apparently, Fidel Castro had his own suite, he had his own car, he had his own library, he could travel around the Isle of Pines as long as he behaved himself. And he was an ideal prisoner at that time. And so then in 1954, there were elections, free elections. Batista was elected the president, and mistakenly, he very, very foolishly pardoned the political prisoners on the Isle of Pines, and Fidel Castro then left Cuba, went to Mexico, which has always been very pro-communist, and began recruiting soldiers and weapons for his attack the following year on Cuba. So that was 1955. He was pardoned in 1956. He is actually preparing then to attack Cuba once again. Do you want to? I guess 1957 is when he attacked the next time. So you pick up the story there. Do you want to tell our listeners what happened next?
What happened next? You have to remind what happened in the what they call the Bogotazo, or you know when President Gaitán, the Colombia president, was killed by the communists in the the uprising over there. Fidel Castro was, after he said that speech, he ran for his life to the then Cuban embassy in Bogota. And on the because he was a Cuban born, he was protected by then President Prio, that he was the president of Cuba, that was the one that he was going not only toward the communists, but toward a corrupt administration. His brother was the, we call it ministers, we don't call it secretaries in Latin America. And the minister of, the treasury minister was Dr. Prio, one of Dr. Prio's brothers.
And it was Dr. Prio that the Batista overthrew,
right,
and a bloodless coup, and I guess it was probably about, what, 1952 or?
Yeah, on March 10, 1952.
Okay.
Around 2 in the morning, now when Batista came to power.
All right. But then, of course, 2 years later, he held free and open elections.
Right.
And by that time, the people were prosperous, there was stability in the country, and he was overwhelmingly elected. The people didn't want to go communist, but, you know, so Batista was elected in a fair and open election in 1954, which the American people have never been told. They really don't understand that Prio, who he overthrew, was a pro-communist person. In fact, you know, Batista had first come to power back in the 1930s, and actually he had prevented a communist takeover at that time. And the American State Department was so pleased with what he did that they actually granted Cuba full freedom up to that time, while it was sort of an American protectorate. But they really totally supported Batista at that time. And then, of course, eventually he held free elections, and he was elected president, I think it was in 1940. He lost the election in 44, left the country, actually was elected to the Senate in 1948, and he didn't even run. Why, the people, his friends, had actually put his name in. And so that's the background of what happened, and then he was asked by the military, because Cuba was about to go communist about 1952 under Prio, why, of course, the military asked him to take over again, which he did. And then in 1954, he was again overwhelmingly elected by the people. So pick up the story. Now we're up to about 1957. Fidel Castro is getting weapons, and of course he's being supplied by, of all people, the American Central Intelligence Agency. He's getting weapons out of the United States. He's getting help, of course, from the communists, and he's preparing for an attack on Cuba in 1957. So do you want to pick up the story there?
Yeah, what happened then, the CIA and the and other organizations, you know, secret organizations, they were cooperating and sending armaments to Fidel in the mountain from the state of Florida. You know, like, for example, the base of Opa-locka, not the, not the, what they call the Miami International.
Right.
But military bases.
And I think it's so difficult for the American people to understand that our government was financing a communist who was going to overthrow the government of Cuba. Why should we be surprised? We finance communism all over the world, as we're financing communism in China today. As, of course, we brought the communist government in Rhodesia to power, which is so chaotic. We financed Russia since its very beginning. Why should we be surprised that we're financing, Fidel Castro's communist revolution? We're financing the communist regime in Uzbekistan, which is totally ruthless and just killed, I think, over 100 people within the last couple of weeks. So, but we're in 1957. The CIA is planning to overthrow the government there and install a communist regime. regime, but we can't let the American people know that. So then what happens? They're shipping all sorts of equipment to Fidel Castro.
Yeah, they were shipping everything, even through, I'm not sure, but I had the rumors in Havana at the time that they were even using the Guantanamo base, the famous Guantanamo base.
And in other words, they were getting equipment for the communists through that?
Through there, you know, and through different small airfields that they are in the province of Oriente, which is where the Sierra Maestra is located. And what happened then, going to 1958, two things happened. I cannot remember the month, but I think it was the month of May or something like that, or March. A colonel, that he was the chief of the military intelligence in Cuba, on the Batista, he was well educated by the graduate from West Point, Colonel Blanco Rico. He was killed by a group of communist students. Now, 2 days later, they told the chief of police, the national chief of police in Cuba, General Salas Cañizares, that those people were inside the Haiti embassy looking for asylum, but they didn't not grant any asylum. What happened then, Salas Cañizares was killed when he went to arrest these people who killed this intelligence military man.
So now they've killed the chief of police, and they've
right.
killed the chief of intelligence, and what you're seeing is the same thing in Cuba that we're seeing, of course, in Iraq today, simply, you know, this increasing level of terrorism and
right.
The breakdown of law and order. And, of course, who's funding the terrorists over there in Iraq today? I mean, where is the money coming from? Why, it's coming from Syria, and where is the Syrians getting it from it? Why, the CIA has been working with Syria all along. It's coming from Saudi Arabia. It's coming from Pakistan. It's coming from Communist China, all of course, of which are working very closely with our CIA. An article just today in the New York Times I'm reading that the CIA is thinking of breaking off relationships with Syria. The CIA is thinking of breaking relations with Syria? I mean, the CIA has been working with Syria all this time? Sure they are. I mean, where do you think Syria is getting the money to maintain the terrorist activities in Iraq, the total breakdown of law and order? Well, this sort of thing was going on in Cuba back in 1957. So you pick up the story there.
In 1958, Batista ordered to have a new election for the president.
Right, but of course, first of all, Fidel Castro attacks, and then he has a landing in Cuba, and most of his force is wiped out. I think there are only 12 men who survive, and everybody assumed Fidel Castro had been killed, but he and about 12 men had made it up to the Sierra Maestra Mountains, whereupon they contacted the New York Times that sent Herbert Matthews down, and Herbert Matthews begins running articles in the New York Times equating Fidel Castro with Robin Hood and with Abraham Lincoln. And these articles are picked up all across the United States. Fidel Castro is the Robin Hood of Cuba. He is the Abraham Lincoln of Cuba. And now, of course, we're beginning to get support for Fidel Castro, this communist revolutionary, being sponsored by the CIA and the people who control the New York Times. So then what happens? Then, of course, Fidel Castro is getting money and men, and because he is being quoted and being labeled, you know, as an idealist, and why he begins to get recruits, because the people figure if America's backing him, he couldn't be a communist. And so more and more people begin to join this small band of 12 men up there in the Sierra Maestra. So then what happens?
Well, what happened was Herbert Matthews interviewed Fidel in the mountains, but then he didn't he printed only the article. He didn't show the picture that he took from him and Fidel in the mountains. Now, Batista was misled by the intelligence.
All right, you're going to have to hold on. We'll just be back in just a moment here. And our guest this evening was Cuban. He lived through this whole nightmare. One another country betrayed by the American Central Intelligence Agency. All right, go ahead and tell the story there. Anyway, what happens at this point?
What happened that Herbert Matthew, Printeriarico, and Batista deny that Fidel Castro was alive. Now, Herbert Matthew have what you call a card hidden in his sleeve. What I mean is he got a picture of him and Fidel in the mountains. And then, after Batista denied that Fidel was alive, Herbert Matthew printed the picture in the front page of the New York Times. That was on February 1957. After that, he already had been a few months in the mountain.
All right.
And then, after that one, the people didn't want to believe Batista anymore because they said, well, if the New York Times is printing this, what they call the true story, and the American administration is supporting, like the underground, the Castro insurgency or revolution, then Batista is a liar.
And of course, probably somebody had fed Batista the wrong information,
right,
intentionally to make him look bad. But then, of course, the CIA will go to any lengths to discredit people, and then, of course, to build up communists, as we do so consistently throughout the world. And you'd think occasionally they'd make a mistake in our favor, but they very seldom do. So anyway, then, of course, Fidel Castro is beginning to get more prominence, and people are really beginning to flock to him because he must be a good guy. The Americans wouldn't be backing him if it weren't. So then what happens?
And then what happened, that 57 was kind of a peaceful in Cuba at the time, but in 58 it started the real attacks, the bombs, exploding bombs like it happened today in Baghdad in Iraq, in downtown Havana, in the different restaurants of people, and they were killing different officers of the army that they were not how they was called. They were called the Batista Army. No, that was the Cuban Constitutional Army. It's not like over here. It's the same thing like over here at the time. It's not the army of President Bush. It's the army of the United States. Well, that was the army of Cuba, and that's what he was doing, attacking these officers and killing them through different people. And when somebody, even a communist, didn't agree with him, he eliminated that person.
You're talking about Fidel Castro.
Right.
And of course, Fidel Castro was very ruthless, and he couldn't get along with anybody. He tried to call a general strike. He couldn't get a general strike going. He really didn't have a lot of support from the Cuban people. A few of them wanted him. There may be people who didn't like Batista, but they certainly didn't want the country to go communist. I mean, the church down there didn't want it to go communist. The people didn't want it to go communist. The last thing they wanted was to lose their freedom to the communists. And yet, of course, the American government was doing everything possible to install Fidel Castro. Now, what's so interesting is that I had an opportunity of talking to Ambassador Smith. Ambassador Smith was a multi-billionaire who was actually appointed ambassador to Cuba in 1957. And I had an opportunity of spending some time with him in 1980 before he passed away. And when we get back from the break, I'm going to tell you the incredible story that Ambassador Smith related to me some 25 years ago. Well, Dr. Stan, Ambassador Earl T. Smith was a multi-billionaire. Had made very, very good money working in the stock exchange. But he was a very nice man. And in 1980, he gave me the opportunity to go down to his home in Palm Beach, Florida, and bring a film crew. And we actually filmed my interview with him there. And basically the story he told me, of course, that Batista was not perfect, but then, would anybody say George Bush is perfect? But the alternative was Fidel Castro, and he knew Fidel Castro was a communist. Our government knew Fidel Castro was the communists, the Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, and the President, knew Fidel Castro was a communist, and we were intent upon bringing him to power. Now, when Ambassador Smith was going to go to Cuba, he was taken into the State Department for a briefing. Now, you would expect that if you were going to brief an ambassador to a country, you would have the experts on the country come and talk to him. But who did they have brief Ambassador Smith? Why, they brought in Herbert Matthews of the New York Times, who had already written these articles praising Fidel Castro as the Robin Hood of Cuba, the Abraham Lincoln of the Revolution. And, of course, one other ambassador did brief Ambassador Smith and told him, be very careful, you're being sent to Cuba to supervise the dethronement of Batista. The State Department is intent upon replacing Batista. Don't leave the embassy. There's going to be revolution there. And look after your safety and the safety of your family. So Ambassador Smith realized, of course, he was being sent there supervise the destruction of a democratically elected government and the replacement of it with a communist government. And that's really so incredible. And so now we begin moving from 1957 to 1958, and we have this increasing tempo of violence. And it's not that Fidel Castro is winning any wars at all. They're simply acts of terrorism in Cuba, exactly the same techniques that they're using in Baghdad and throughout Iraq today. So then what happened, Gonzalo?
Well, in 1958, you know, Ambassador Smith, they forced Batista to celebrate free elections again, and they pushed him to do it. Anyhow, Batista told, he removed himself and everybody on his family. They cannot run for any political position by election.
Now, of course, there was supposed to be an election in 1958 anyway. He was elected in 1954 for a four-year period. 1958 comes, and there's going to be election, I believe it was in November of 1958.
November 1st, and the then Prime Minister, Rivera Agüero, he was elected by the Cuban people, and he's supposed to take over on February 24, which is a Cuban holiday.
And, of course, Cuba is really very, very staunchly a Catholic country, isn't it? The Catholic Church is very, 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 very strong there.
Yes.
So then what happened? So
What happened after Rivera Agüero was elected president of Cuba, then the pressure started coming on Batista to leave the country, period. Because Ambassador Smith, probably I don't have his book, but I heard about it, that the Ambassador Smith told President Batista, you have to leave the country even before February 24th.
And now, Chris, basically, this is written in it's a book called The Fourth Floor, and you can, it may probably is still in print if you want to get it. I have my own copy, but we don't carry it for sale. But the ambassador told me this on film, and we do have the film, and we'll be making it available to our listeners in the not-too-distant future, if you'd like to see it. And Ambassador Smith said he was instructed by the State Department to go to to Batista and tell him he would have to leave the country. Now, the Catholic Church had said, look, if Batista leaves the country, there's going to be chaos, and Fidel Castro is going to take over. Let's, of course, get Fidel Castro to declare a ceasefire and Batista a ceasefire, and let's set up a provisional government and give the people the opportunity to vote for a different president. But let's have democratic elections. The State Department refused to support it. The Catholic Church and the Catholic leaders pleaded with the American State Department, and the American State Department said, oh, we can't get involved. And yet they were involved at every turn, and the CIA was funding and financing Fidel Castro. But they said, oh, we couldn't get involved in the internal affairs of Cuba. And as Ambassador Smith said, they were involved at every turn. And so it was, of course, that Ambassador Smith went to Batista on, I think it was the 27th of December, and said, you will leave the country. And, of course, on January 1st, on the morning of January 1st, after the New Year's Eve party on December 31st, Batista left the country, plunged it into chaos, which is exactly what our government wanted, and Fidel Castro was brought to power and immediately recognized by the American State Department. Gee, I wonder why. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest this evening is Gonzalo Marina. We're talking about what happened in Cuba. And so now on the 1st of January, 1959, why Batista flees the country. And about 6 days later, why Fidel Castro takes over the country. And then what happens, Gonzalo?
Well, what happened on January 1st, after Fidel find out that Batista has fled Cuba, then he went to Santiago de Cuba, which is the second, in Oriente province, is the second most populous city in Cuba, only second to Havana. And what happened then, he sent two of his commandantes to Havana. One was Camilo Cienfuegos, then later he became the chief of the armed forces, and then the famous Ernesto Guevara, Che Guevara. Now, those were the first two commandantes who arrived in Havana, I think it was January 2nd. And then they took over the controls of the Cuba. Now, the students in Havana, the university students at the time, they were pleading the Ambassador Smith, for my memory, that please let us have a free election. We don't want a Fidel Castro. Because Fidel Castro couldn't even control the students in only a small group. Now, what happened on January 6th, Fidel arrived in Havana in top of a tank after he came through the main highway in Cuba. And then he made his famous speech in the military base, the biggest military base in Cuba, that by coincidence got the name of Columbia, like a D.C., the District of Columbia. Then that's when he said in his speech that he had repeated many times that he was not, at the time, that he was not a communist.
Of course he was lying, but of course, but this is what was picked up by the American media. And who knew he was a communist? The people in the New York Times, the people in the American establishment knew he was a communist, but they certainly weren't going to let the American people know that, and they were trying to confuse the people of Cuba so they would not resist the coming terrible tyranny.
Absolutely.
So then what happened?
Then what happened after that one, he started doing what they call the agrarian reform. And he started doing the what they call the urban reform.
But didn't he also arrest people and kill about between 10 and 15,000 people in mass trials? And, you know, they have trials, you know, in the football stadium and the baseball stadium. And then they just take the people out and shoot them. Now, they had no capital punishment under Batista, in fact, when Fidel Castro had led a revolutionary march. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Once Fidel Castro got in power, he started, they killed, and the figures, estimates are about 15,000 people. They simply had show trials, and they took the people out and shot them. These were the people who'd been in the military, people who'd been in positions of authority. Anybody who would oppose the revolution was summarily executed. And, of course, there'd been no capital punishment under Batista. Actually, Fidel Castro had led a revolution. He had attacked the country, and he was sent to prison, and he was actually turned loose in 1955. He was allowed to leave the country. But once Fidel Castro came to power, why, there was capital punishment. And where was the outcry from the United States? What did the United States do about this tyrannical individual who was killing all the opposition there in Cuba?
They did nothing. They did nothing.
Did absolutely nothing.
Absolutely, they did nothing. On the contrary, they were saying that he wasn't killing anybody. Another thing, the Cuban Constitution, that was still at the time, prohibited the capital punishment. And that's the reason why Fidel was able to walk away from jail.
Right.
Even though he you know, in the attack on Moncada, which it was on July 26th, that was the barracks in Oriente province, in Santiago de Cuba, he killed about 80, according to the records, about 80 members of the military, but these people, they were in a hospital. They were not fighting. And that's the people he attacked. And still, after that one, he was allowed to go to jail only. And then he was pardoned 18 months later. But what happened then, going back to 1959, he summarily, they found some of the people innocent. Still, he make another, a second trial for the same people, and then they found them guilty because he chose another judge.
Right, and of course, the thing is that they would terrorize the judges and going along and coming up with every decision that Fidel Castro wanted, and he started killing all of his enemies. He was a ruthless murderer. And yet this is the man who's still so built up by so many newspapers and magazines in the United States. In fact, he even comes to the United States to address the members of the Council on Foreign Relations. And in 1995, the wicked Fidel Castro has a private meeting with David Rockefeller. You'll find that in David Rockefeller's memoirs. I wonder what they were laughing about when they were together. Be that as it may, that's David Rockefeller's memoirs in very small print. You'll find they had a private meeting in 1995. Why would the head of the Council on Foreign Relations, which was instrumental in bringing Fidel Castro to power, why would David Rockefeller hold a private meeting with Fidel Castro, this mass murderer? Go ahead, Gonzalo, why don't you tell us a little what happened. Now, Fidel Castro's then is, how many people do you think he killed at that time? Do we have any idea?
According to what I recall, approximately between 15,000 and 20,000 people got shot and killed.
All right, there's a wonderful book called Dagger in the Heart that uses the figure as 15,000, but we don't know. Right. I mean, after all, what's 5,000 people when we're actually bringing a communist paradise to being in the Caribbean? So, anyway, Fidel Castro then has killed all of his opposition, and he's killed a lot of innocent people, a lot of people who were just doing their job working for Batista, and these were not murderers, these were not criminals, they were people who did not want a communist regime. And this pretty well must have terrorized a lot of the people in Cuba, didn't it?
Absolutely. He terrorized the Cuban people, and he terrorized even every family, because he didn't kill you, he was putting you in jail for no reason at all, just to, like you said, terrorize the people, and to give the impression that he was in the absolute power.
Right. So then what happened?
What happened then, he started...
He began to collectivize the farms, take over the property, and so really the government then came to own everything, because this is what socialism is all about, when the government owns everything, the means of production, the means of distribution, all the property, everything is owned by the government. That's socialism.
The first farm, or the first ranch that he... nationalized, and he gave to the poor, was his own mother. That was the first what we call finca that he nationalized, to show that he didn't have any feelings for anybody. That was the first agrarian reform that he made.
And I've actually seen pictures of Fidel Castro actually taking his picture out and shooting people. Are those real pictures or those sort of staged?
No, I don't think that he shot anybody himself.
All right.
Maybe when he was in the mountain, I think he shot a couple of rebels that they were fighting with him, but he said that they were traitors.
All right, fine. So then he got other people to do the shooting then.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, he got Che Guevara and the head of the intelligence, the Minister of Interior. Minister of Interior is not like over here. He doesn't take care of the forest. He takes care of the jails, and he takes care of the secret police. That's what we call a Minister of Interior. And what happened, they've been in jail. Another thing he did, some of the militaries, they don't, you know, when you go to kill somebody, you don't shoot to the head. With some of them, and it's so new from that time, that happened, they shoot it to the head, and mm-hmm. they blow the head of the these military people at the time, back after the kangaroo trials that he did in Havana and in the province of Las Villas, which is in the center of Cuba. And after that one, he started, then Ambassador Smith left, and they brought Ambassador Bonsall, B-S-M-B-O-N-S-A-L, Philip P. Bonsall, and he came from Bolivia, and he was fluently in Spanish. Now, Ambassador Bonsall tried to, after he presented his credentials
to Fidel Castro, right?
To Fidel Castro, he tried to get another interview with him, but Fidel was delaying and delaying because he was working with, the communists in Czechoslovakia at the time to bring the total control of Cuba under the, you know, with the advice and consent of the Czechoslovakian government that at the time was a communist. Then, after that one, on I think it was September 1959, Comandante Camilo Cienfuegos, the chief of the armed forces, he was kind of a uprising by another member of the rebel elite, that he was in charge of a whole province, you know, like a state over here, and he tried to start criticizing Fidel. Now, Camilo Cienfuegos went from, because he was the chief of the armed forces, he went from Havana to Camagüey, which is border with Oriente. And what happened then, on his way back to Havana, the plane that he was bringing Camilo Cienfuegos was shot down by Czech pilots that there was at the time under the control of you know, the Fidel Castro Javi. And then he got this commandant in Camagüey, put him in prison, and he just got free a few years ago. He put him in prison for 30 years.
For 30 years. Well, let's talk a little bit about the Bay of Pigs, because the Bay of Pigs came about in 1961. Remember, Fidel Castro came to power in January of 1959, and so we're told, of course, when our government suddenly realized that the CIA, the communists had put Fidel Castro in power, now we're going to try to overthrow him, and so we are planning the Bay of Pigs invasion. Do you know much about what happened to the Bay of Pigs?
Well, what happened at the Bay of Pigs, it was preparing, the people who was training, he was training in Guatemala, and the place that they left was Puerto Cabezas, which is in Nicaragua. That's a magnificent place to start, you know, because it's very difficult to see it from the, unless you see it from the air. And that was a secret port that the Somoza have in Nicaragua.
And but this was all CIA financed, right? Even though our government lied to the American people and lied to the world, why the CIA was actually training this army to invade Cuba now to put down the government that we'd brought to power. So what happens? I mean, why did the Bay of Pigs fail?
The Bay of Pigs failed because whatever they said over here, the press tried to say over here, Fidel Castro knew. And the place they chose it, which is the Suamo Zapata, that's the wrong place. Now, another thing that happened, President Eisenhower told President Kennedy at the time that you have to give air cover. Otherwise, these people are doomed to defeat. Well, Kennedy authorized only one attack. And that happened on Saturday, April the 15th, 1961. Then, Sunday the 16th, the plane were canceled. And some of the lesser officers in the CIA, they was screaming and crying to the big bosses in Washington not to leave then abandon. Now, the American fleet in the Caribbean was right down there with the aircraft. In other words, they could have launched the planes from the carrier. But no, the order from President Kennedy at the time was, that's it, one attack. Now, that's when Fidel knew that nothing was going to eliminate him. And then when he was, because he was ready to leave Cuba for Mexico again. But then when he find out that Kennedy has ordered no more attacks, and those planes, they were all B-57s, that they were coming all the way from Nicaragua, and they didn't even allow them to land in Key West or in Miami, even though they knew that they don't have enough tanks.
Enough gasoline, right.
Right. Enough capacity to go back again to Nicaragua, and some of those planes, they had to ditch in the ocean.
Now, I think that's what's so important for our listeners to know, that there are many, many beaches. Cuba is an island. Lots of lush beaches, lots of places to land. There was one place you would not want to attack, and that was the Bay of Pigs. Why? Because it was surrounded by an impenetrable thicket. They call it a swamp. It was a thicket. There was just no way through it. There was only one way off this long stretch of beach, and that was up a highway, and there was a military camp with 5,000 Cuban soldiers in training on the camp. Now, I had the opportunity of talking to the officer in charge of the war room at the Pentagon at that time. The Bay of Pigs was not where the original attack was going to be made. They were going to make it where they could actually get the men on the shores, and where, of course, if they initially failed, they could get up in the Sierra Maestre. There was to be an uprising of the Cuban people. There was a network of anti-communists throughout the islands ready to rise up against Fidel Castro going along with the attack. Number one, they never told the people on the island to rise up. And secondly, they changed the landing site from where it could have succeeded to the Bay of Pigs, the one place they could not succeed. And as the officer I talked to told me, everybody in the Pentagon went out, at Pentagon War Room, went out and got drunk that night because they knew those men were being sent in to die. And that's what it was all about. We did not give them any more supplies. We did not give them any air cover. We knew they were going to lose. They had something like 50,000 Cuban troops there before long, and the people simply ran out of ammunition. But the American people were never told that. They were told, oh, well, somehow there had been a cross up in Washington, D.C., and I don't know who made the decision. I rather think it was McGeorge Bundy, I've been told. I remember McGeorge Bundy, member of Skull and Bones, member of the Council on Foreign Relations, national policy advisor, close friend of Henry Stimson, who had gotten us involved in World War II. In fact, the two of the men, both members of CFR, both Skull and Bones, both got together and wrote a book called On Watch. And McGeorge Bundy, who was well rewarded for his treachery, he left the National Security Council and became president of the Ford Foundation. McGeorge Bundy gave the order that there would be no more attacks, and left those men there to die. But did the Cubans really realize that this was a conscious, intentional act of betrayal?
I think after the fact, what happened, because then on April 17th, that was Monday, the only attack by air was on April 15th, was Saturday, and April 17th, Monday, they was still telling the brigade, 2506, that the number of the brigade, that they were in their ships, that the landing was going to be continue. That in you know, the orders came from Washington, even though they didn't tell them that they was stopping the air bombardment of the different military bases of Fidel.
Now, because they could have evacuated from the beaches, they could have got them out, they could have got them back to the ships.
Right.
They didn't want to get them back. They wanted them to die, or at least be captured, and then, of course, we could justify giving massive financial aid to build up Fidel Castro's faltering government, because socialism doesn't work. And we had to pump a lot of money in there, And, of course, we did that under the guise of ransoming back those men who had been abandoned. So we could have taken them off the beach. We did not. And then, of course, we ransomed them back eventually after they'd been, you know, many of them had been killed and mistreated by Fidel Castro. But those who did come back were ransomed. And that way we could justify giving massive financial aid to bolster Fidel Castro's communist government. But the American people couldn't understand that. They were never to understand that this was all a scam, and those men were sent in there to lose. Because if they did, they might rise up. They might even begin to understand what's going on in Iraq today, where we've created a very, very similar situation, and we've done it intentionally. And the terrorists in Iraq, where are they getting their money? I mean, it takes a lot of money. In fact, we talked to a man just this afternoon who was over there working with the intelligence, counterintelligence, and, of course, to get the people to carry out the terrorist attacks, they have a large sum of money they give to the family before and then, of course, after they kill themselves and killed a lot of Americans or other civilians, they get another maybe $100,000 or more. Where is that money coming from? Well, it's coming from Saudi Arabia. It's coming from Syria and Iran, according to this man from the Central Intelligence, from the Counterintelligence Agency. Why? I thought Saudi Arabia was our friend. And well, we'll be back in just a moment with our special guest this evening, and then we'll wrap up this evening's program. Well, Gonzalo, it's hours going very, very quickly. What are things like in Cuba today? Do you still have friends there? Are they letting you know what's happening there on that island paradise? We're told here in America what a great job they're doing.
Well, no, it's not an island paradise anymore. It's like a gulag. The whole island is a gulag. You cannot escape. And like you said in the beginning, if you try to escape and you get caught, what they call dry feet, wet feet. In other words, you get caught even in the beaches of Miami, but in the waters, you'll be returned to Fidel.
And the American government, Fidel, sends you back to Fidel. We must understand it is the American government that is doing everything they can to help Fidel, but we can't tell the American people that.
That's true. And that's what happened also in Venezuela right now. That's another country that they could have had overthrown Chavez. And they don't want to do it. They want to keep him in power. You know that now they want to create an image that Chavez is an enemy of the United States. When in reality, the same thing they did with Fidel. They tried to show that Fidel was somebody who they can do business with him. And there's no way for anybody to do business with these people as long as the small elite or multi-billionaires or trillionaires today, they keep trying to run the world.
And they finance both sides. They finance the communists, they finance the anti-communists, and they play one group against the other, just exactly as they're doing in America today, with the Hispanic people coming into this country, encouraging illegal immigration. So why do they want the illegals here? Why? So they can play the Hispanics against the Anglos against the Hispanics. It's the oldest trick in the world, and you'd think that the American people might begin to understand what's going on. Well, maybe if we tell them, they will. We're just about out of time. Do you have a parting thought for our listeners this evening?
Well, the only thing I can say is still it's time to wake up. But, I mean, you cannot look at the politicians of today. With very few exceptions, the politicians are not talking about anything against the American people. On the contrary, I appreciate what the militaries are doing. But the politicians are the ones that they are corrupting any government, any administration, because they want to stay in power forever. It's like a doctor in medicine or a lawyer or anything else.
Oh, God bless you. We're out of time, but thanks very much for being with us tonight. Bye-bye.
Anytime.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. The story of what happened in Cuba is amazing, and you're never going to get this to the regular channel, as I don't think one person in a thousand know that the people of Cuba overwhelmingly voted Batista into office in 1954, and they carried another election in 1958, but of course we did not want a stable country there. We wanted Fidel Castro, and the CIA and the New York Times and the American State Department brought him to power. Well, I mean, these stories are told, and we actually have a video we've actually produced. It'll give you all the information. It's not as well filmed as I'd like it to be, but the information is all there if you'd like to get that, if you're interested in it. Otherwise, we're hoping to have a much better film here before too long tell the story. But the information on the one that we have now is excellent, and of course, if you want the information, it's all there in the video Cuba, the Untold Story. And of course, it's available by calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Then, of course, we hope many of you would want to get some of our other material. If you have not seen our video, Iraq, the Untold Story, you need to get that along with the syllabus. If you get the two of them together, of course, it's a much better situation, much better deal. But basically, this goes into all the wars of the last century and points out how they were all contrived, from the sinking of the Maine to the sinking of the Lusitania, to the Gulf of Tonkin, which didn't occur, to, of course, the justification for going into the First Gulf War, and now the justification for the war we're involved in today. They have all been contrived, but there is a common purpose behind it, and that is the New World Order and the New World Religion. So until people really begin to understand that aspect of what's going on, until they understand that there are forces working behind the scenes, you can't understand anything going on. And if you've not yet read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to give serious consideration to getting it, or get the video or the audio tape or get all of them together. That's the Brotherhood of Darkness, the book, the video, or the Brotherhood of Darkness special. But let me suggest the video. It's called Cuba, the Untold Story. Now, I will apologize that the quality of the video is not as great, but the material is all there, and you'll actually see my interview with Ambassador Smith, the interview that we actually did back in 1980, and you'll actually hear him tell you the story that I just told you. Nobody else has seen this footage before, so you'll certainly would like to get that. And then, of course, we have Iraq, the Untold Story, the book, the syllabus and the video, and then of course we have a new CD. It's called The Coming Crisis. It will tell you what's happening financially in the world. That's The Coming Crisis, and it simply goes into the background of the coming financial crisis and what Paul Volcker has said and what Alan Greenspan has said and what you can anticipate happening. And we'll give you the history of our monetary system and what nobody else is going to tell you, and that is the occult background behind the monetary system. And then, of course, don't forget my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness. You need to get that. You need to help us get the message out, because behind everything isn't the occult hierarchy that really does rule the world. And then, of course, we have this great new video. My hair looks a little funny in the video, but other than that, the material in it is great. As far as the fluoride deception, that the video is actually called Hidden Agenda, the Fluoride Deception. And then, of course, we have the history and toxicity of water fluoridation. We have a syllabus. We have a DVD. Now, we have another DVD on fluoridation of drinking water, but the DVD, my new talk on the fluoride deception, is must-watching for everybody, because, you see, they really are poisoning our children. And if you can get people to understand that, why, who knows? We might even be able to get some people to be willing to get away from the television set and understand that their freedom, their future, their families are under attack. We'll be back again with you on Monday. Until then, may the Lord be with you. Vail. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Caring, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But before we open up our calls, we want to introduce our guest for the first half hour. His name is Marty Schechter, and he's with Pro Ben Soap Company? Oh, let's see. Yeah, Marty, are you there?
I'm waiting for you. And
okay, fine. That's Cal Ben Pure Soap. Go ahead.
Correct.
Okay. What is there anything new at all in the soap business?
Many, many things. First, I want to thank you, Dr. Stan, for inviting me again to your wonderful show. It's so wonderful talking to you and your listeners, getting them some information they can't get anywhere else on cleanliness, on health, on purity, on products that are so much better than what's offered in the supermarkets today.
All right, fine. Well, of course, you've been at this for some time, but this is a sort of a family concern, isn't it?
Yes, we're still a family company, family operated. My father and I started it in 1947. I've got 58 years of going down the drain.
All right, fine. Well, what can you tell us about your products and why people would want to get them rather than the other things that are so readily available?
Well, first I want to ask you, Dr. Stan, how many germs did you kill today?
I haven't the slightest idea.
Well, everybody's trying to kill germs. The fear of germs is growing and illness is spreading. There's a greater demand for household cleansers and personal care products with antibacterial properties. But many, many doctors and experts and scientists say that when it comes to washing, good old soap and water may be enough to improve the consumer's health. And this is what we manufacture in Oakland, California, pure soaps. Bath soap, hair soap, dish soap, and laundry soap that'll do 200 jobs. Their products are triple concentrated. They're twice as good as what you can buy anywhere. The people and the families and the consumers not only use our products for many, many decades, not only do they like our products, but they love them. We create love affairs literally with everyone and anyone that gets back to good old-fashioned 18th and 19th and early part of 20th century pure soaps that are not available anymore. They've been discontinued. Everyone, all the chemical manufacturers are making detergents made from waste petroleum with additives like dyes and perfumes and chlorides and lanolins and all the chemicals and solvents and pastes and liquids that permeate a detergent that does more harm than good.
All right, fine. So basically, of course, then you are producing soap and laundry soap rather than the detergent, which is so commonly used today.
Almost all products are detergents. Even the famous Ivory Snow and Ivory Flakes that's been around for 100 years. You can look at it on the shelf and see Ivory detergent.
All right, we'll be back in just a moment here with Marty Schechter. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Marty Schechter. Marty, what's the difference between a soap and a detergent?
Well, a soap is made currently, now not from the past, 40, 50 years ago, soaps were made from animal fats, animal tallows, etc. Currently, with the new technology, we make soaps from vegetable oils and coconut oils that are safe, that not drip the soil off the cloth, but melt and dissolve the soil off the cloth without deteriorating it. Big difference. Detergents are made from waste petroleum. They're adding sodium chloride in there. Most people don't know what sodium chloride is. That's table salt. It makes the detergent flow better. But it's a inert ingredient. It also contains dyes to make it look pretty. It contains perfumes. Perfumes are toxic. You can't put perfumes on your skin and not get an irritation. Sure, it smells good. It's a wonderful fragrance. But it does. You can take a drop of pure perfume, put it on a walnut desk. Overnight, you will have a bullet hole in that desk. It will deteriorate the wood. Now, endlessly and constantly, all the chemical manufacturers are having what we call a perfume war. Who's got the newest smell? Who's got the better smell? Who uses more of this and more of that? And the consumer could walk down the detergent aisle in any supermarket and literally cough and tear and feel irritated, and you can't breathe that stuff. Well, we don't go that route. We're old-fashioned, we're family-orientated, family-produced, family-owned, family-partnership. For 58 years, we've been concentrating. Now, we haven't always sold our products to consumers. For 45 years, I'd say at least, all our soaps were made for hospitals, school departments, motels, healthcare professionals, all over the country. It's only a couple of years ago that the light bulb went on in my brain and says, hey, here we've got these super concentrated quality products. We should start telling consumers about it. We should advertise. We should, in a sense, get them to get our samples, our products, and compare the differences between what they're buying now and what the future holds for them with all natural, earth-friendly, pure soaps. And we learned a new word, which we've never used before. We're getting letters and telephone calls and faxes, and they say, Marty, your products are awesome.
Hold that thought there for just a moment, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Marty Schachter with Cal Ben Pure Soap. Marty, how can people, first of all, learn more about your soap, and then how can they get in touch with you and get some samples of the soap? Now, do you have a website that they can go to?
CalBenPureSoap.com.
That would be www.CalBenPureSoap.com?
That's exactly. We got all beautiful color photographs. All our items are on there, order forms, low prices, wholesale prices, and they can order by web, they can order by fax, they can call us toll-free, 800-340-7091. That's 800-340-7091. Some states have to put a 1 in front of the 800, but I'm sure you know that.
All right, fine. That's 800-340-7091. And of course, this is a laundry soap, a face soap, a washing soap, and a hair soap. So what's the difference between a hair soap and a regular soap? Why do some people want to use special soap on their hair?
Well, they have been sold a bill of goods. It doesn't take much to go to any supermarket or drugstore or discount house and go to the shelves where all the shampoos are. And you got to look and pick up a bottle of the top name brand. Look at the label. It has anywhere from 20 to 25 chemicals in that shampoo. And I mean, between the dyes and the perfumes and the chlorides and the botanicals, now why do they put botanicals or flowers in the shampoo? Botanicals don't clean, but it reads good, it looks good, and all these products all have on them, and this blows your mind, keep out of the reach of children. Now, don't children wash their hair? Why should they have that kind of warning on it? They do because of the chemicals in there. Our shampoo only has two ingredients, coconut oil and vegetable oil, plus a few drops of pure orange juice. We don't use perfumes. We use juices of oranges, of lemons, of cherries, all to give it a little flavor, but not to stay on your hands, stay in the air, stay on the towels, and hurt, harm, pollute, and burn. It's safe, it's food, it doesn't hurt anything. We have the soap products packaged in a special, what we call like a Whitman sampler. It's a sampler of pure soaps. It's about 10 inches by 15 inches tote bag, and it weighs out about 6 pounds. We UPS direct to the door. It's got 4 bars of a beautiful, wonderful pure soap. It's got 18 ounces of our granulated laundry soap with a little tiny scoop. It's got 16 ounces in a dispenser bottle of our triple concentrated cocoa butter shampoo. It's got 16 ounces of our liquid cream dish soap called Dish Glow that can not only be used for pots and pans, utensils, mop the floor, do the windows, clean anything, wash the car. It's safe, no warning labels on it. It's a white cream liquid pure soap that does just about everything. Also include a large nylon scouring pad. And you say, what is a scouring pad? Well, it's a 6-inch by 9-inch, about a quarter of an inch thick, made by Minnesota Mining Company. It's spun nylon. You can cut it in half, cut it in quarters with scissors. It replaces Ajax, Comet, steel wool, SOS pads, curly cates, chore girls. Don't need those anymore. With this little pad, you can not only do white sidewall tires, but you can clean copper, make it look like new pennies. It'll clean your pots and pans of heavy baked-on grease. It won't hurt the skin. It won't hurt anything. It cleanses. That's included also the special package. We call it a one-month tote bag. It's on the web. It's also, it'll last a family of four, anywhere from 4 to 8 weeks, conservatively. A lot of product there, a lot of concentration. Got a book of instructions, how to use each product, and all the different uses for each product. You can wash your hair with the bar soap. You can wash your dishes with the shampoo. You can make an all-purpose cleaner with the granulated soap. 2 tablespoons and a gallon of water, and you've got the best all-purpose cleaner money can buy for pennies.
All right, fine. Well, let's get that telephone number out just one more time, how people can give you a call if they'd
800-340-7091. That's 800-340-7091. And we include a catalog of everything. It's a great, great, inexpensive buy. And you, once you try it, you're going to love it.
All right, fine. Well, thank you so very much, Mighty. We really appreciate it. We'll look forward to talking to you next month.
Can I leave with a poem?
You certainly can.
A bee's a busy little soul. He has no time for birth control. That is why, in times like these, we have so many sons of bees.
Bye-bye. Good night. All right, fine. That was Mighty Schachter. And, of course, we're going to have sort of open lines the rest of this evening. So if you're out there in the listening audience would like to give us a call, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But this afternoon we had a guest. He had actually been in Iraq. His name was David DeBato. He's written a book called A CIA a Team 3. It's a Central Intelligence Team 3. And he was, of course, with the counterintelligence unit traveling in Iraq during the 2003-2004 era. He had, of course, been in law enforcement. He'd been in and out of the military. He felt, really motivated to go back into the military to fight for his country while he was over there. Well, of course, his impression of what was going on, really a tragic situation because nothing was working. In other words, the electricity wasn't working. There was a sense of lawlessness, and he said, as bad as it was when he was there, it's far worse now. Now, when we destroyed the Iraqi military, and he talked about when he was there, why Paul Bremer, because you remember, of course, he worked very, very closely with Henry Kissinger, he was actually part of the plan team that had planned this whole war on terrorism a year before the 9/11 attack. He had put out a report on the possibility of an attack on America, and it started, well, he'd opened in that report, and we have the report, with about two pages from a book on Pearl Harbor, and the whole theme of how Pearl Harbor came about, why it was, aw, shucks, nobody knew what was going to happen. There was no communication, nobody was talking to anybody. People were afraid to tell their bosses about what was going to happen, and it was simply total incompetence that brought on Pearl Harbor. Now, why would anybody put out a report, about a terrorist attack on America in the year 2000? Why would they put a report out on 2000 going back to Pearl Harbor and saying it all happened because of incompetence? And, of course, a year later, his report, as I remember, came out in September of the year 2000 and in September 2001. Why we had an attack on New York City. And the excuse was, gee, we were all so incompetent, nobody was telling anybody else, and the CIA couldn't talk to the FBI, and the FBI couldn't talk to the CIA, and all I know is that I've talked to FBI agents who told me they could talk to the CIA all the time, but that isn't what they told the American people. And of course, we use what happened on September 11th as a justification for attacking Afghanistan to capture the wicked Osama bin Laden. We never tried to capture Osama bin Laden. Now, if you doubt that, why, we have an article out of the Washington Times. We'd be glad to send you free of charge, where they actually quote a high government official who said, "We're not going into Afghanistan to capture Osama bin Laden." As I remember, the article was the 5th or the 7th of October, 2001, just as our troops were moving in. And this high official is saying, "We're not trying to capture Osama bin Laden. Our policy is not to get Osama bin Laden first. If we got Osama bin Laden, how would we justify the war?" And that's what it was all about, ladies and gentlemen. We couldn't get Osama bin Laden. If we did, how would we justify the war in the minds of the American people? And the wonderful book we carry called Crude Politics by Paul Sperry, who was formerly the chief foreign correspondent or the Washington correspondent for the World Net Daily. And in that book, he tells about talking to people who had been there in Afghanistan with the special forces. And the special forces, the American special forces in Afghanistan, were not allowed to go after Osama bin Laden. I will tell you that the book was not distributed by the publisher. A few thousand copies went out. They still have the majority of them. And I talked to Paul, and he said the publisher told him that they weren't going to try to distribute the book. Why wouldn't they try to distribute a book? They got a lot of money tied up in it. They got all those copies sitting in a warehouse. Well, we can't let the American people know that we never wanted to get Osama bin Laden. We never tried to get Osama bin Laden. If you don't remember Richard Miniter's book called Losing Bin Laden, it listed 11 different times when we could have taken out Osama bin Laden. And President Clinton had given orders to take out Osama bin Laden. And the CIA, which has no hesitation at all about killing people, either in this country or in other countries, said, oh, gee, we wouldn't want to take out Osama bin Laden. It might create an international incident, or his family wouldn't like it, or whatever excuse they always use. They always had an excuse not to get the wicked Osama bin Laden, who was planning an attack on America, and they knew that. Why would we not try to get him? Unless we wanted a war so we could justify, first of all, going into Afghanistan, and then, of course, justifying going into Iraq. And the most incredible thing about Iraq is that we sent over a civilian administrator. And who is it? Well, it's Paul Bremer, who put out the Bremer Report back in the year 2000. And one of the first things he does is dissolve the Iraqi army and dissolve the Iraqi police force and fire everybody who knows how to make the electricity work and how to make the water work and the sewers work. And you know, you end up with chaos. Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment. We're going to welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here at 464-8295. That's 831-464-8295, right here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. We're going to have open hours, open lines for this hour. Always enjoy that. We've got Rick calling in from Texas. And again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Hi, Rick. How are you doing?
Hello, Dr. Stan. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thank you.
On the previous hour, you were talking with a Cuban
right.
concerning Castro takeover.
Right.
Two very good books. One is by an information officer who was in the American Embassy in Havana between 1957 and 1961, when relations were broken. Was named Paul Bethel. He wrote a book called The Losers, the title referring to people like the New York Times correspondent,
Herbert
Matthews.
Right.
Yes, the ones who were trying to build up Castro. And
now, what was the author's name?
Paul D. Bethel, B-E-T-H-E-L.
All right.
The book was published in 1966. I found it in the used bookstore.
And what is his explanation for Cuba going communist?
State Department, connivance in the embassy. He was the information officer, and he said all of them were working against Ambassador Smith.
All right, because I had the opportunity of interviewing Ambassador Smith, and I'm not at all surprised by that.
Yes.
He realized, of course, that the State Department was intent upon toppling Batista and bringing Fidel Castro to power, and they all knew that Fidel was a communist. So why would they have done that unless, of course, as so often is the case, we bring communists to power, creating the best enemies money could buy?
Exactly. And another book, it was published in 1998, Decision for Disaster Betrayal at the Bay of Pigs. It's by Grayston Lynch. He was one of two CIA operatives that were with the men on the beach, the only Americans who landed with them. And he shows from the beginning, when they were in Nicaragua, they had been given this type of landing craft that was new. Well, experts came from Washington and started to give them instructions on maintenance that would have destroyed them. So from that point, he and this other operative, Robertson, realized they're trying to stop the whole thing. But they went ahead and went on with it, and of course, by cutting the number of airstrikes by the Cuban Air Force from 3 to 1 with only 8 planes, Castro was left with a T-33 jet fighter and 2 British Sea Fury attack planes, with which they sank the supply ships.
All right, now, of course, what was the first name? His last name was Lynch, but what was the first name?
Grayston.
Grayston.
G-R-A-Y-S-T-O-N.
Now, did he talk at all about the fact that they changed the landing site? You know, it was not supposed to go in at the Bay of Pigs, but it was any other place but the Bay of Pigs, because there was no way off the beach. And, of course, the only way off, of course, was to be evacuated off, because there was no way to fight up that road, and there was no way to get into the community, so there was no way to get, away or up into the mountains or anything else. That was the only one site in Cuba where you would land and be sure to lose. Did he bring that out?
Yes, it was originally supposed to be at the city of Trinidad, which was, I'd say, perhaps 100 miles from where this landing site was. They didn't like it, but of course they were ordered to go, and they had a lot of camaraderie with the Cubans, and these people stayed with the Cuban underwater demolition teams that were sent in to clear the bay for the men to land. Well, they were the only ones to get away.
Now, how did the CIA officials get out? How were they able to get off the beach?
Because they were with one of the ships that didn't sink, with
right.
the UDT team.
Hold that thought there. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest is Rick. He's calling in from Texas. Again, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And, of course, he is talking about a book by Paul Bethel called The Losers, published in 1966. And, of course, Paul was working in the embassy there in Havana, pointing out that the embassy was always working against Ambassador Smith. In other words, Ambassador Smith was trying to, if not keep Batista in power, to come up with an interim government, but anything but bringing Fidel Castro to power. And according to this book, at least according to our caller, the book The Losers, why the people in the embassy were trying to bring Fidel Castro to power and trying to undercut Ambassador Smith. The second book he mentioned is A Decision for Disaster by Grayston Lynch, published in 1998. And, of course, he was with the CIA. He was in at the Bay of Pigs and realized, of course, that they had changed the landing site at the last minute from a place where they could have won to the one area that they there at the Bay of Pigs where they were guaranteed defeat because it was surrounded by an impenetrable thicket. And there was no way off that beach except to go up a pathway, go up a road, where there was a large military, a Cuban military base, and 5,000 soldiers there. And, of course, we did not resupply the people on the beach. We did not give them the air supply. They were simply set in to die. But we couldn't tell the American people that. We had to give the impression, oh, shucks, we were trying, we did our best. It's sort of like the story about the attack on 9/11. Oh, shucks, we'd have been known why we sure tried to do something about it. We would just have such incompetent people in government. And ladies and gentlemen, we do not have incompetent people in government. We've got some of the smartest people in the world. They got to be awful smart to deceive the American people over and over and over and over again. Okay, Rick, what else would you like to cover?
Well, one further point. The President Somoza of Nicaragua, who gave the base the Americans to use and Cubans to use to try and knock out Castro is what they thought. Well, President Carter becomes president and helps the Sandinistas to overthrow Somoza, who was a friend of America, and then later he took refuge in Paraguay while a communist assassination team from Argentina killed him within the month that he was there. And so now we're left with Latin America. Brazil is communist under Lula da Silva, Venezuela's communist under Chavez, who's giving oil to Fidel Castro. Most Americans know nothing of this because the news media never brings up that these countries are now communist.
And, of course, we have communist governments pro-communist governments in Chile. We have pro-communist governments in Peru. We have pro-communist governments certainly in Central America. All of South America is going communist. There's a very a Marxist government in Argentina today. And the average American has no idea that all of this is coming about by design. It's not happening by accident. What's happening is why the Marxists are saying to the people down there, look, if you don't get us in power, you don't keep us in power, why the wicked Yankees are going to come down from the United States and they're going to take away our freedom and they're going to take away our oil and they're going to take away our rights and they're going to enslave our people, so you back us. We're going to form a free trade zone of South America and you're all going to have to give up your national sovereignty and join together, but it's the only way we can combat the wicked Yankees. And of course, what we're really doing is giving the people a Hobson's choice. I mean, do you want, of course, to have the free trade zone of the Americas and bring them under American influence where they lose their freedom? Or do you want them under Marxist influence where they lose their freedom? But either way, they lose their freedom. Rick, go ahead.
Exactly. No, you're very right. And same thing with South Africa and what used to be Rhodesia, both communists.
And the average American doesn't know we brought a communist regime to power in Zimbabwe. We call it Zimbabwe today. It was Rhodesia. And I was just reading an article about that. Their currency on the legitimate market. Now, it used to be the three American dollars for one Rhodesian dollar. The regular market today is 9,000 Rhodesian dollars for one American dollar, but the black market rate is about 27,000 Rhodesian dollars for an American dollar because nobody will trade, dollars for Rhodesian currency because it's becoming useless. 5 million of the 12 million people there have fled. There is no gasoline. There is no food. There is no medical supplies. There is no electricity. The whole structure of the government is collapsing, and you're not reading about that in your local newspaper, because remember, we brought that government to power. We forced the people to accept Mugabe. The people originally had elected a man named Bishop Mizraweo, a very moderate black man who would have been a good administrator, yeah. And we demanded new elections because we wanted the communists in power, and we got just what we wanted, and the Rhodesian people agreed to this because Henry Kissinger promised that we would never allow what's happening to happen. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Rick. Our guest is gone, but we're going to have open lines. We have Rick on the line from Texas. And, of course, we have the ability, if you'd like to call in, at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And I was just saying that Henry Kissinger went on to television in Rhodesia back about 1976, 1977, and promised the people of Rhodesia that if they would simply turn the power over to Mugabe, that America would guarantee the stability of the country. He said America would guarantee a legal system there, would guarantee free elections, would guarantee property rights, and guarantee the court system would work. And if anything happened, America would step in and protect the people. If they'd only trust America, just trust America. And you know, the Rhodesian people trusted Henry Kissinger. And the Rhodesian people trusted the American State Department. And the Rhodesian people trusted the American people. And as Ian Smith said, we were betrayed by our enemies. We were betrayed by our friends. And that's the great tragedy of what's going on in Rhodesia today. Go ahead, Rick.
No, exactly. And by the British. The British had guaranteed the Rhodesians they wouldn't allow Mugabe to win the election. They would have allowed one of the other two less violent guerrilla leaders, and that's not what happened. The British also betrayed the Rhodesians, and later America and Britain betrayed South Africa, letting the Marxist Nelson Mandela and the African National Congress in power in South Africa. So,
yeah, but you see, the American people don't know that. I mean, they never understood the significance of the fact that when Nelson Mandela, oh, this great humanitarian, this champion of freedom, when he came to power, and of course, I don't know how many of you saw him, standing in front of the communist flag with his raised clenched fist. But Nelson Mandela, who was there to celebrate his, coming to power? Why, there was Gaddafi of Libya, there was Fidel Castro of Cuba, the communists were there from Russia. Communists throughout the world understood what was happening. I take the communist papers here in the United States, both political affairs and the communist world, daily, it's now a weekly world, and everybody knew, every communist in America knew that Nelson Mandela was a communist. He'd always been a communist. And it's amazing how they could conceal that fact from the American people. It's amazing, of course, when you control the media, how you can create the reality of the American people.
Exactly.
Anything else you'd like to say, Rick?
No, sir, and God bless you. You're doing so much to get the truth spread out.
God bless. Thank you.
God bless you.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. We're going to have open lines. If you'd like to call us, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And right now we have Roger from Allentown, Pennsylvania. Hi, Roger. You have a question or comment?
Yes, if you please. Thank you, Dr. Stan. I guess, the same exact slot last Friday evening. You had an evening with Daniel Sheehan. I guess you're calling that tape, and I thought it was very jam-packed full of bombshells on CIA, FBI, and such.
No, I thought that it was very, very interesting talking about bombshells. Well, Sheehan is appealing the decision of the judge who has treated him so unfairly, and of course it's going to the appeals court, and the chief of the appeals court gets a letter bomb and is killed. And of course they put in another judge and Sheehan loses the case.
Yeah, no, your voluminous knowledge and elephantine memory certainly managed to bring out the best of the guy. And you know, Stan, I never thought I'd hear myself, and I'm asking for any caveats here, but in part, I never thought I'd hear myself saying I believed everything from someone from the Christic Institute or from the Jesuits, both of which I recall were, of course, heavily involved in liberation theology and such in Central and South America. But there you have it. Now, I just thought that would make a very worthy tape for the listeners to get. I thought I'd have to listen two or three times myself till it all sunk in. And I did want to ask if, in retrospect, you think that it could all likely be accepted as face value, or as it sounded to me like it all could well be, or are there any caveats that occurred to you anywhere or in retrospect? And that's it. God bless.
All right, fine. Well, Roger's calling and asking about a program we did just a week ago with Daniel Sheehan. And Daniel Sheehan had been with the Christic Institute. And if you read the books that were circulated in conservative circles at that time, why, the Christian Institute was simply a front for Marxism. But then of course, the Christic Institute had brought a lawsuit, had named a number of people who had been involved with the Iran-Contra issue, and, of course, was suing them under the RICO Acts and under all sorts of things for violating of the laws of the United States. When, of course, they went to court, the judge refused to allow any evidence to be presented, said there'd be no evidence because they had no right to bring this lawsuit, and then charged the Christic Institute for the court expenses for the people on the other side without ever allowing, of course, the case to be heard. When Daniel Sheehan, who was representing the Christic Institute, then appealed the case to a three-man appellate court with two good, honest judges on it, and one, of course, a fellow he knew was dishonest. Why, of course, just before the case is going to go to the appellate court, why one of the good judges, the chief judge of the three, gets a letter bomb that kills him just by coincidence, and they appoint another judge who, of course, then throws the case out of court, and the Christic Institute has to pay $1 million in legal expenses and is destroyed. And, of course, a lot of good people felt, well, good riddance, because, after all, they were a communist organization. Well, let me tell you that communism, and certainly communism is a terrible system, and I despise the philosophy of communism, but anytime anything goes wrong, they always blame it on the communists. And what the average American doesn't understand is that from the very beginning of communism, it has been financed by people of great wealth. You go back and you read about Karl Marx. Who financed Karl Marx? He was financed by a man named Frederick Engels. He was the son of a wealthy British manufacturer. Karl Marx was financed by an organization, a secret society, known as the League of the Just. The League of the Just. And you go back and you read the 1911 British Encyclopedia Britannica, they will tell you that. More modern, of course, versions will not tell you about the League of the Just. But somebody had to finance Karl Marx so he could sit around and dream up all these stupid things that he did. Because if you read Marx's writings, they're really not very, very clear, not very concise. Now, he did have a few great slogans in the Communist Manifesto. Now, you know that, of course, working men of the world unite, you have nothing to lose, but your chains, something of that sort. You have a world, you have nothing to lose but your chains, you have a world to gain. A beautiful rhetoric, but his whole Communist Manifesto was simply the idea of centralizing all power with government and creating a dictatorship of the proletariat. And anybody who's read it would understand that. You can't understand why people who value freedom, anybody who values freedom, would support a dictatorship by the government over the proletariat, because that's what it was really all about. But that's really always been the purpose of socialism. It has never been to redistribute the wealth of the wealthy, although they will tell you that. It has always been, of course, to centralize power in the hands of a ruling elite under the name of democracy. And you go back and you read the Communist Manifesto, written in 1848, or published in 1848, and of course you will find over and over again it talks about the importance of democracy. Well, of course, it was people of great wealth, and the League of the Just was an organization, a secret organization of people of great wealth who funded the communist movement. And then, of course, you find that the communist movement is picked up, or at least the socialist movement is picked up by the Fabian socialists in 1884, something like that. And these are people of great wealth. They're people that got a lot of money behind them. Beatrice and Sidney Webb, they've got a lot of money. And, of course, George Bernard Shaw and Annie Besant. And of course, you'll find Bertrand Russell coming in there. These are people well-financed. H.G. Wells comes along before very long. And these people are working hand in glove with people of great wealth. In fact, a wonderful book that I recommend it to you, it's called An Experiment in Autobiography by H.G. Wells. And in this book, An Experiment in Autobiography, Wells talks about the regular meetings between the Fabian socialists and the people who control banking in England. The Cecils, Lord Milner, Edward Grey, the book, An Experiment in Autobiography, they had regular meetings between about 1902 and about 1908, planning on how to bring about their world order. And here you're having the socialists working with the capitalists, with the bankers. And it's all right there in the book if you read it. And out of those meetings came several books that H.G. Wells wrote about the open conspiracy, the New World Order. If the plans were laid out very, very clearly. And here you find the socialists working with the capitalists. See, the average university student honestly believes that socialism is going to help the common man. No, it is how you are going to enslave the common man. In fact, if you would like to understand socialism, let me suggest that you get a book written by George Bernard Shaw entitled An Intelligent Woman's Guide to Socialism and Capitalism, or Capitalism and Socialism. I think it's Capitalism and Socialism. And if you want one, we can simply send you the page I'm going to refer to. But in that book, George Bernard Shaw writes, and this is the last page of the book in the appendix, he said, socialism has not been defined, so let me define it for you. When I say socialism, I mean equality of income or nothing. Under socialism, you would not be allowed to be poor. You would be forcibly housed and clothed and fed whether you liked it or not, and if it were found that you were unworthy of all of our efforts, you might be put to death in a kindly manner. But while you lived, you would have to live well. It's all about force. It's all about control. It's all about regulation by an elite. Of course, if you really see the end result, you're not going to be living well. You're going to be impoverished as the people in communist Rhodesia are today, where there's no gasoline, there's no electricity, there is no food, money has become worthless, and are you hearing about this on your television? The article I just read in the New York Times telling you this, but this is not going to be picked up by your local newspaper. The average American has no idea the terror that we have brought to that country. 12 million people, 5 million of the 12 have already fled. 5 million of the 12 million people are now refugees living in other countries, and they've even gone to Mozambique. Things are going to be pretty bad before you flee to Mozambique. They're living, of course, in South Africa and in Zambia, and they fled any place they possibly can. They fled for their lives because they would be slaughtered there. People are starving to death in Rhodesia today. And are you hearing about this on the radio? Are you hearing about it on the television? Are you reading about it in your newspaper? And another genocide is taking place in Rhodesia today. And the response is deafening in its silence. There, and absolutely no word at all is getting out. We did a wonderful interview. In fact, we did a couple of wonderful interviews with Peter Hammond on this afternoon, evening, and morning interview. In fact, on Monday of this week, we did the interviews with Peter Hammond. They'll be played on this coming Monday. If you missed it, it'll be played on our afternoon program. We really need to get it. Peter is there. He knows what's going on. He was raised in Rhodesia. And you need to understand that those people are dying. They're starving to death today in Rhodesia. And not a word in the media. Exactly as when they were hacking 800,000 Christians to death in Rhodesia. It was blacked out by our media. And Bill Clinton was saying, don't mention the word genocide. Why, if you mention the word genocide, why, we would have to go and do something. And if you haven't seen the DVD, it's out right now, Hotel Rwanda, get it and understand that we intentionally let that happen. And Rwanda back in 1994, and we're letting it happen in Rhodesia today. Well, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And we have Roger once again from Pennsylvania. Hi, Roger. How are you doing?
Yeah, just Stan, just the same. Any caveats, or last Friday may well stand intact.
No, I think that what you heard from Daniel Sheehan was excellent. I believe everything he said was right on. And you see, what they want to do is label anybody who speaks out against, of course, what we were doing in Nicaragua as a communist. In other words, what they're doing is playing, you know, we actually toppled Somoza. We brought the Sandinistas to power. And then, of course, we financed the Contras to fight the Sandinistas that we'd bought the power. So, once again, you've got this whole situation. We create chaos in that once formerly a prosperous country. And so Sheehan is down there. He's trying to bring out the fact that there are people in our government who violated the laws. There were laws against sending money to the Contras. There were laws against sending military supplies to Iran. And yet, certainly General Secord and Admiral Poindexter and Oliver North were all involved intensely in breaking the laws of the country. Now, this was, of course, was a government operation. It had been suggested by the president, but President Reagan was not involved in this. Simply, he let them know that he wanted something done to get rid of the Sandinista, and then he left it up to the intelligence agencies, just exactly as I'm sure President Bush let the intelligence agencies know that he wanted an excuse to go to war with Iraq, but how they got us there was not his business. In fact, when it actually came down that morning, if you remember, if you've seen the Michael Moore film, President Bush was frightened to death. He couldn't get out of his chair there when he was in Florida. He was reading a textbook about a goat, the children there. And he sat there for 6 minutes after he knew America was under attack. Why? Because he realized the implications of what had happened, and he was frightened to death. He's not a very courageous guy, if you've ever met him. He's not the sort of man who'd really, you'd want to follow into battle. And, of course, he is the President of the United States. America's at war, and what am I going to do? So he just sits there until finally, of course, he's told again, and he's got to get up and leave, and he has to face the reality of what his policies have wrought. But he didn't plan the attack on the World Trade Center. It was planned by our intelligence agencies, but they didn't tell the President, because if they told him, and it had ever come out that he was involved, it would have brought down the government. And so this is how intelligence operations work, and that's exactly what happened with the Iran-Contra affair. The president didn't know. In fact, Admiral Poindexter at one point said, President Reagan would love to have known what we were doing, but we would not tell him because he had to have plausible denial, and that's what it's all about. And George Bush has plausible denial. He didn't know what was going to happen. I'm sure he didn't know the day of the attack, how the attack was going to come about. That was all left up to the intelligence agencies. And of course, if you've read the book entitled See No Evil, we actually carry it, written by Robert Baer, who was with the CIA, was a CIA agent. He quotes one of the highest-ranking officials in the CIA as saying, when the dust settles after 9/11, the American people will realize that what happened was not a failure for intelligence, it was a success. When the dust settles after 9/11, the American people will realize that what happened was not a failure for American intelligence, but a success. How could it be a success when almost 3,000 Americans were dead? Why, very simply, it got us into the war in Iraq, and aren't you happy about that? Wasn't that a great success? If you want to check that, the reference you'll find in my newsletters. We carry the book, See No Evil by Robert Baer. You need to get it. You need to read it. I will even send you the page of that if you don't believe what I'm saying. Anyway, let's go to anything else you want to say, Robert? Roger?
God bless.
God bless. Let's go to Tom is calling from Ohio. Hi, Tom.
Dr. Stan, I was wondering, have you heard from Dr. Len Horowitz lately?
No, I haven't. Len, of course, last time I heard, he was living over in Hawaii. He had put in a sort of resort over there. And he was, of course, into all sorts of various alternative medicine things. But I'm certainly indebted to Len for the work that he did as far as the origin of AIDS is concerned, because he had a profound impact on my life. And we do carry his book, Emerging Viruses, and which I think is a very important contribution. And he has some excellent websites up there. But right now, he's sort of taking a little sabbatical into some other things.
How much is the book?
Oh, the book, I can't give you the price over the air, but if you call that 1-800-544-8927, why, they'll give you the cost. It's an excellent book, though. It's called Emerging Viruses, AIDS, Ebola, and Other Viruses.
What do you see coming down the pike here, Dr. Stan? Something big going on. What do you
think?
Well,
I think that they're preparing for some sort of a flu influenza. I think they're conditioning our minds. And I believe this, of course, is going to be a genetically engineered virus. They know how to create viruses. We know that back in 1969, and we have the testimony, incidentally, if you haven't seen it, we'll be glad to send it to you, Tom, where Dr. MacArthur went before the House Appropriations Committee in 1969 and asked for $10 million to create a new organism, a new disease, for which there'd be no immune response. $10 million. He said some people think we shouldn't do it. It's another form of mass killing. Well, we want to create this organism, and just 10 years later, the first cases of AIDS appeared.
You actually have that on tape?
We actually have we'll tell you when we get back. Well, you can give us a call if you want to order the book, and just ask for the Dr. MacArthur article. It comes from the House Appropriations Committee. We'll be glad to send it to you.
Thank you, Dr. Stan.
God bless.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. I might just comment that I was going to have Len Horwitz on my program, and so a couple of days before he was going to come on the program, in over my fax machine comes this government report, and it's the House Appropriations Committee, 1969, that contains Dr. MacArthur's testimony I was just telling you about. And of course, it's right there. I mean, we got it. It's a 50-60 page report. And sure, when we got Len on, I said, "Hey, Len, thank you so much for sending that report to me." And he said, "What report? I didn't send it to you." So obviously, somebody in government knew I was going to have a Dr. Horwitz on and wanted me to have the information. So we actually have the pages from that report. We provide it for people free of charge. Or if you get our hidden agenda syllabus, and that, of course, goes into the background of water fluoridation and population control, we actually have that report in there, along with so many other reports. That's the hidden agenda report, but we'll be glad to send you those pages free of charge if you call us at 1-800-544-8927. Right now we have Dale on the line from Aptos. Hi, Dale. How are you doing?
Pretty good. God bless you, Dr. Stan. And hearing all this talk going on about what's going on and what's happening, and I'm sure all we need to do is take a look in the papers, and there's a certain cycle of speech that these people use to let people know, and so they just put it in people's faces that they told people, or that they're telling people what's going on. But I want to ask you if you've come across something that I was unaware of until very recently. A man named Myron Fagan, and back in the 60s, this was recorded in 1967.
On the Illuminati, yes.
Yes, and what can you tell me about that you know about him, and maybe do you know any guests that have a lot of knowledge about Mr. Fagan?
Well, Mr. Fagan was with the movie industry. He was very successful, as I think he was a screenwriter, whether he was a producer, I don't know, but he was very well known back in the 60s, and of course, concerned about the communist movement. And then he began to realize that there was a force behind communism. The one thing about his these are actually on records, is that there are a lot of anti-Semitic overtones in that, as if somehow the Jews are behind communism, which of course is not the case at all. But he has a lot of good information, but because of the people who actually were with him and helped him actually put that out, it's something that I can't use in my ministry, because this is not a Jewish conspiracy. It's a Luciferian conspiracy that involves all great religions today. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we're going to wrap up the program, but we have Dale calling right now. So, Dale, have you heard the three records?
Actually, it's on an amazing website called educate-yourself.org, and there's somebody that did a transcript on it. So it's in four parts in text.
All right, fine. Well, I think there's a lot of good information in there, and it goes into the background of the Council on Foreign Relations. But I'm sure in those days there wasn't the knowledge of the occult forces, the spiritual forces that are whole energizing this whole movement and their anti-Semitic bias, their anti-Christian bias. And so perhaps it's a little of what we've added to understanding through our book, The Brotherhood of Darkness, and so many of the newsletters we have up on the Internet.
Right. So long as we use proper discernment with our Lord Jesus Christ in our hearts, I think it provides people with an excellent overview about what's going on and what's coming.
I think there's a lot of good information there. As I say, that I'm a little hesitant to use it because a few of the things there, when you're in my position, why, you've got to be 100% right all the time. That's pretty hard to be.
Right. Amen, brother.
God bless you. Thanks
very
much.
Take care.
Okay, bye-bye. All right, fine. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I'm, of course, going to be at the Conspiracy Conference this weekend. It's going to be at the Westin Hotel over there in Santa Clara. And then, of course, we'll be back with you again on Monday. We do hope that many of you will go to our website, RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. And you can pull out our Internet programs there. 5 hours a day, either directly or linking to the American Freedom Network, or GCN Live, and then, of course, we're on other Internet sites. We're on, of course, RadioLiberty.com. We're on RBN.com. We're on Soundwaves2000.com. Our evening programs are 3 hours in the evening. So you can get lots of Radio Liberty. You can listen to us 4 hours a day on the shortwave. You can listen to our archive programs. But what you can really do to help us will be to tell other people, to try to get them to think, to go up on our webpage and pull down the newsletters. And as you pull down these newsletters, you can begin to get information and understanding about what's really going on in the world today. How do you connect the dots? Well, of course, if you read what we've written and check out the documentation, it's all there. It's accurate. I was rereading something that only one place have I found any mistake, and that is I attributed one quotation to William Shakespeare that should have been attributed to Lord Byron. But other than that, I haven't found any mistakes in any of those articles, and I want you to get them, and I want you to read them. That's RadioLiberty.com. Remember, of course, we do carry some products, the Berkey products, and if you, Sanjian radios, other things that do help maintain our ministry out across America, because it's an expensive thing buying radio time, I'll tell you, but it's so important. We are on over 60 different radio or stations or outlets every single week, bringing people the news behind the news, the story behind the story, and introducing them into the concept, into the understanding that we're involved in a spiritual battle, being fought on a political and ideological and cultural battlefield, a battle for the souls of men. Now, if you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get it. That's Brotherhood of Darkness. If you haven't heard our video, Iraq, the Untold Story, you should get it along with the syllabus. We have a great new CD on the coming financial crisis. I was asked earlier, I think it was Tom, wanted to know what I thought was coming. We're going to a financial crisis. I believe that there's going to be a major chemical or biological or nuclear attack on America. And behind that, I believe God's judgment is coming on this country. For as Thomas Jefferson had said so well, I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just and his justice will not sleep forever. And so understand what's coming on, prepare yourself spiritually, and help us to reach others in as many as we can in the time that's allotted to us. Pray for America, please, and pray for Radio Liberty. Remember our number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Until Monday, may the Lord be with you.